The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. And this is the Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the August 14th, 2026 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week, we actually have two Democratic donkeys. One of them is wearing a traditional blue suit with a blue tie. The other one's got on a red T-shirt. He's wearing a beanie cap with a couple of buttons on it. One's a watermelon slice. One says, "Eat the rich." They're sitting at a wooden table and getting ready to arm wrestle, both with fierce looks on their face. The headline is Power Struggle. Moderates and socialists wrestle over Democrats' direction. We'll get that story in the controversy of the week. We'll start with the first main story. U.S. low on missiles as Trump seeks exit from Iran. What happened? President Trump claimed that a deal to reopen the Strait of Hormuz and end the war with Iran was close at hand this week, as multiple news outlets reported that the U.S. military was running perilously low on long-range precision missiles and missile interceptors as a result of the five-month conflict. As the week went to press, Iran said it was in the final stages of negotiating a deal with Oman that would see the strait, a vital conduit for Middle Eastern oil, reopen under joint control. No tolls or service fees, a major U.S. sticking point, would be charged for at least 60 days under the deal, Axios reported. Any agreement would be dependent on the U.S. lifting its naval blockade of Iran's ports. In a familiar pattern that has emerged since the start of the war in February, Trump vowed last week to unleash military terror on Iran before citing diplomatic progress on the strait and Iran's nuclear program as a reason for stepping back. Amid the negotiations, Reuters reported the U.S. military had used most of its stockpile of highly accurate long-range missiles. Three sources told the outlet that virtually all of the Army's long-range munitions, including Army tactical missile systems and precision strike missiles, had been fired, raising concerns about America's readiness for future conflicts. Meanwhile, CNN reported that air defense systems were dangerously depleted, with the military having used close to 80% of its THAAD interceptors and half of its Patriot interceptors. Trump insisted that the U.S. has far more munitions than anyone in the world and far more than we need. What the columnist said, "There are reasons to be skeptical about the potential longevity of any straight deal," said Tim Lister in CNN.com. "Iran's hardline Revolutionary Guard is absent from negotiations and would have to sign off on any deal. And the fact remains that the U.S. and Iran have irreconcilable agendas. Control or supervision of the strait is now a red line for Tehran, but the prospect of such leverage is unacceptable in Washington, Abu Dhabi, and Riyadh." "Iran believes it has the upper hand," said Erica Solomon in the New York Times. To the mullahs, Trump backing down from a threatened military escalation yet again telegraphs to the world that they are not the ones who fear war. Trump is. The Iranians believe they've found the world's Achilles heel in the critical energy facilities and waterways that sit across the Persian Gulf, and which Iran has shown it can damage and shut down with drones, ballistic missiles, and help from regional allies. The mullahs are not about to give up that power, and Trump doesn't fully grasp how they refuse to be bullied or cowed. As Trump swears Iran is eager for a deal, investigators believe Tehran is behind a recent wave of cyber attacks on municipal water systems across the U.S., said Dan DeLuce in NBCNews.com. The administration confirmed last week that malicious cyber actors had attacked water operations in seven states, including Minnesota, Michigan, and New Jersey. The breaches follow warnings from U.S. officials that Iran-backed hackers were targeting the nation's critical infrastructure. But Trump dismissed the idea that Iran was involved, blaming the Minnesota attacks on the state's Democratic governor, Tim Walz. Meanwhile, an alarming email sent by military commanders shows how the Trump administration is floundering in its hunt for an off-ramp, said Rachel E. Van Landingham in MS.Now. In what we can only wish was satire, CNN reported this week the U.S. Central Command emailed military analysts seeking creative and unconventional ways to pressure and punish Iran. It's close to a straightforward admission that our plan in Iran is failing, and it cannot be overstated that sending out such solicitations is not how professional, competent militaries achieve success. Trump's mandate now is to find the least bad way out, said Jonah Shepp in New York. Under pressure from the public, his party, and Gulf allies, who last week beseeched him to not escalate the conflict, he wants and needs to end this war. But short of a ground campaign, he has no realistic path to anything he can cast as a win. With Iran empowered by its newfound leverage over the strait and willing to absorb Trump's bombs, even a return to the pre-war status quo, with an open strait and restrictions on uranium enrichment akin to what Iran agreed to in 2015, seems hopeless. At this point, it's no longer a matter of if he'll lose this war, but how. And the controversy of the week, the left. Should Democrats embrace democratic socialists? After notching a string of Democratic primary wins in New York City and Colorado, the far-left Democratic Socialists of America will face its biggest test next week, said Caroline Vakil in The Hill. If the polls are right, the likely winner of the Democratic gubernatorial primary in Wisconsin will be State Representative Francesca Hong, 37, a tattooed former restaurant worker and proud DSA member who a few years ago called for the abolition of Thanksgiving. Hong has sought to distance herself from that statement and from the DSA's radical platform, which includes such proposals as abolishing the police, prisons, borders, and the U.S. Senate, as well as ending U.S. support for Israel. Because of that baggage, mainstream Democrats like current Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers doubt Hong can beat the GOP's presumptive nominee, Representative Tom Tiffany, in November, and worry she'll hurt down-ballot candidates. But Hong's supporters see no need to stress. They note the rising anti-establishment mood among Democrats and voters in general, and say the narrow win by progressive Abdul El Sayed in Michigan Senate Democratic primary shows there's a possible path to victory in purple states. The Democratic machine is fighting back as best it can, said Noah Rothman in National Review. The Democratic National Committee last week tweaked its presidential primary schedule to favor centrist-leaning states like Nevada and South Carolina, which should help ward off the insurgent socialists in their ranks. But with 1 in 3 Democratic voters now identifying as a Democratic socialist, it may be too little too late. This is a story of establishment collapse rather than left-wing ascension, said Asted Herndon in Vox. Candidates like Hong are winning over normie Democrats not with the DSA's extreme ideas, but by pushing popular measures. New taxes on the super rich, Medicare for all, restraining the artificial intelligence industry. The rudderless Democratic establishment, by contrast, is offering nothing except ineffective opposition to President Trump. We need better labeling, said Jonathan V. Last in The Bulwark. The truth is that a likely majority of DSA members and the overwhelming majority of those who tell pollsters they're Democratic socialist aren't socialist at all. They're social democrats in the European tradition, like the DSA-endorsed Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the Democrat from New York. Their main objectives are an expanded welfare state, including universal health care coverage, funded by a more progressive tax code. Social Democrats also want to win elections, meaning they could be a great asset within the Democratic coalition. Not so the DSA's Das Kapital-loving, Mao-admiring, genuine socialist, who need to be rejected before they do to the Democratic Party what MAGA did to Republicans. Democrats should stop whining, said Paul Waldman in public notice. With the primaries largely over, it's electoral self-harm to keep screaming half of our candidates are crazy. The party centrists need to understand that with control of Congress in the balance, they have an interest in seeing all Democrats succeed, even those who are too progressive for their taste. Whatever happens in November will inform 2028, said Nia Malika Henderson in Bloomberg. If DSA-backed candidates can pull off victories in purple states, then a new template will emerge on how to win. But if those candidates lose, the Democratic Party will have less power than ever to rein in Trump's many excesses, and will sail toward 2028 still wrestling with itself over what it actually believes. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for furries after UCLA conservation biologist Daniel Blumstein launched Only Marms, an OnlyFans page featuring images of wild marmots to help offset federal funding cuts to his research on the rodents. It's going to be G-rated, said Blumstein. We're not going to sexualize this. It's a good week for the golfer-in-chief. After President Trump, who has a reputation for cheating on the green, claimed to have shot a round of 70, two below par, to win both the senior and super senior club championships at the Trump National Golf Club in Bedminster, New Jersey. It's called talent, the President 80 posted online. I have it, and they don't. It was a good week for Gen X nostalgia. After the Trump administration announced it was exempting power plants that primarily serve data centers from pollution standards that curb acid rain, the largely mitigated ecological threat that was a mainstay of headlines and dystopian fiction in the 1980s. But it was a bad week for geography. After a State Department presentation at the AIDS 2026 conference in Brazil featured an AI-generated map of Africa that mislabeled every single nation and turned the West African country of Ivory Coast into a landlocked entity in Eastern Africa. It was a bad week for overpacking. After TSA workers at Alabama's Gulf Shores International Airport discovered five Civil War-era cannonballs, apparently stolen from nearby Fort Morgan inside a passenger's checked baggage. Even if inert and not active, travelers should avoid bringing weapons of any kind, including replicas, to the airport, said the TSA. Finally, it was a bad week for drama. After the musical director of a Vermont production of the Rocky Horror Picture Show admitted he'd faked anonymous threatening text messages that caused the show to be canceled. Police said Kenneth Grenier had been having cast problems and wanted an excuse to step away. In other news, Trump plans to radically lower Head Start standards. The Trump administration is proposing a dramatic overhaul of federal requirements for Head Start, the 61-year-old early education program for impoverished children. The Department of Health and Human Services revealed plans this week to shrink Head Start's 133 pages of requirements for class sizes, medical screenings and curricula down to 12 pages, while leaving most specifics up to states. The draft rules, which the public will have a month to comment on, also require more documentation from parents who are homeless or unemployed. An early version of the proposal barred immigrants in the country illegally from enrolling their children, even those who are U.S. citizens in the program. The White House last year called Head Start radical and tried to freeze spending on it. If the new plan is enacted, said former Head Start Administrator Carl Garvin, we'd have the carcass of Head Start. This week's briefing is titled, Defunding America's Best Idea. Trump administration policies have left many national parks short on staff and money. How popular is the park system? The National Park Service recorded some 323 million visits to its 433 parks, properties, battlefields, and monuments last year. That's a slight drop from 2024's all-time high of 332 million, but more than the combined attendance of professional football, baseball, basketball, NASCAR, soccer, and Disney theme parks. Established in 1916, the NPS is today one of America's most beloved institutions. A 2024 Pew Research Center survey found that 76% of Americans, including overwhelming majorities of both Republicans and Democrats, view it favorably, a higher share than for any other federal agency. But the NPS, which manages more than 85 million acres across the U.S., now faces an uncertain future because of staffing cuts and the reallocation of critical funds by the Trump administration. Author and conservationist Wallace Stegner once declared national parks America's best idea. But the administration is treating our treasures like anything but, said John Garter of the nonprofit National Parks Conservation Association, the NPCA. How many national parks workers have been laid off? The agency has lost nearly 25% of its permanent workforce, over 4,000 positions since the start of the second Trump administration, according to the NPCA. About 1,000 parks employees with probationary status were fired in early 2025, while senior staffers have been let go through deferred resignation and early retirement programs. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum, who oversees the NPS, said the agency can keep up standards with a reduced workforce by getting staff to focus on hands-on jobs, such as clearing trails. I want more of that, he said. I want less overhead. Staffers who traditionally work behind the scenes have been pushed into more frontline roles. At Yosemite National Park, a shortage of custodial workers in spring 2025 meant the park's scientists, IT specialists, and senior management had to take shifts cleaning toilets. Personnel cuts and delays in hiring seasonal workers have caused backups at entry gates, which at some big parks have been exacerbated by the scrapping of timed entry reservation systems. The traffic reminded me of L.A. at rush hour, said Sacramento resident Walter Meyer, who visited Yosemite in April. Are these cuts affecting park safety? Dive team operations were quietly suspended at Southern Nevada's Lake Mead National Recreation Area in May because of staffing shortages and the need for more training and equipment. The lake has consistently ranked as one of the deadliest sites managed by the NPS, with an average of 20 people dying in the park annually, mostly by drowning. One of the dive team's responsibilities is recovering the bodies of drowning victims. An NPS employee at Yosemite told The Guardian that a lack of workers last year meant visitors could wreck the park with no consequence and get away with doing potentially dangerous things, such as not properly storing their food. "We don't want bears eating people food because they can get aggressive," said the staffer. "I worry the park will degrade to the point where safety is a problem." And the problems faced by national parks have only grown this year as President Trump redirected funding toward his preferred projects. How is Trump spending that money? At least $90 million from visitor entry fees to parks such as Big Bend and Yellowstone has been diverted to Washington, D.C., the Washington Post reported in early June. Much of that cash went toward Trump-requested beautification projects ahead of the country's 250th birthday celebrations, including $76 million for fountain repairs and for the botched relining of the Lincoln Memorial reflecting pool. Entry fees were used to fund a 4th of July firework display at the Capitol. It cost $1.6 million, more than five times the bill in past years. NPS also spent $689,232 this spring to rip up the walkway connecting the Oval Office to the White House residence, a 45-second commute. Trump didn't like the historic beige Tennessee flagstone and has replaced it with polished black African granite carved in Italy. Park advocates say all that cash would have been better spent tackling the NPS's $24 billion backlog of needed infrastructure repairs and improvements. "This is not how it was designed to work," said NPCA's Ed Sterley. "It shouldn't just be all at one park at the expense of the entire national park system." Are many parks missing out on funding? More than 900 NPS projects that were slated to be funded this year have yet to receive money. They include a $1.5 million roof replacement at the Yellowstone Center for Resources, which is dealing with water leaks and pest invasions. Guardrails won't be replaced along a cliff edge deemed a significant safety hazard for visitors at Colorado's Black Canyon of the Gunnison National Park. And crumbling walls along a scenic drive won't be fixed at Virginia's Shenandoah National Park. At Crater Lake in Oregon, potholes riddled the main drive, and two housing units for employees have been shuttered because of mold. Is anyone trying to protect the NPS? Some members of Congress are speaking out, as are NPS staffers. When the Trump administration started shrinking the workforce, a group of off-duty and former employees formed Resistance Rangers to document NPS's cuts and policy changes, while fired workers flew an upside-down American flag, a distress sign, at Yosemite. Meanwhile, lawmakers in Washington have rejected plans in Trump's 2027 budget to lay off nearly 3,000 more NPS workers and shrink the agency's budget from $3.2 billion to $2.2 billion. No lawmaker wants to be responsible for defunding such a beloved agency. Plus, said Senator Lisa Murkowski, the Republican from Alaska, "I just need to know that I've got people out in the park who are keeping the bears at bay." And a few of the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S. The big lie about the pool fiasco. It was no real surprise when federal prosecutor Jeanine Pirro admitted last week there was no evidence that the Lincoln Memorial reflecting pool had been vandalized, said Aaron Blake. But that's what makes this farcical episode so scandalous. The Trump administration had charged former U.S. Olympic canoeist David Hearn with a felony after he reached down to touch a piece of the disintegrating, newly installed blue bottom of the pool. Absurdly, Trump claimed the algae growth and failure of the renovated pool's bottom was the work of radical left vandals bent on destroying our country's precious monuments. Trump, Pirro, and other administration officials scapegoated Hearn, claiming to have photos of vandals cutting a 300-foot-long gash in the bottom. Those photos never arrived. Pirro dropped all charges against Hearn after receiving the Department of Interior's own analysis, which revealed the peeling paint was the result of botched installation and not vandalism. A furious Trump said he was really disappointed in Pirro, saying that she choked and folded under pressure. This surreal episode tells us that to work for Trump, you must be willing to deny reality, even if it means throwing an innocent man in prison. Intact families help students succeed. Bigotry isn't the primary cause of racial disparities in school performance, said Ian Rowe and Brad Wilcox. When news recently emerged that only 3 of the 777 incoming students at New York City's elite Stuyvesant High School were black, activists and politicians immediately seized on it as proof of discrimination and a rigged system. But the main reason behind the negligible black president as Stuyvesant, as well as Asian students' 2/3 share of the student body, is not about skin color. It's about family structure. Only 30% of black children in America live with 2 married parents, while 80% of Asian kids do. Data from the National Survey of Children's Health reveals that children from non-intact families are 13% less likely to earn good grades, 47% more likely to cause discipline problems, and twice as likely to be depressed. None of this excuses a school system that has failed black, Hispanic, and low-income families, nor does it mean we must simply consign children from unstable home environments to a dismal future. But we can effectively address learning disparities only if we can be honest about why they exist. This column comes from Luxembourg. China's secret door into Europe. China is using Luxembourg as a Trojan horse to infiltrate Europe, said Jeremy Baruch and Manon Romain. More than 120 Luxembourg-based companies are actually controlled by the Chinese state, and they have spent tens of billions of dollars snapping up businesses elsewhere in Europe, including leading technology companies and strategic real estate. Linxens, a French technology gem that makes components for contactless payments and biometric passports, was bought by a mysterious Luxembourg-based firm that was created just before the deal and operates out of a mailbox. If you follow a complex chain of shareholders, you find Tsinghua Unigroup, controlled by Beijing. Meanwhile, a sovereign wealth fund overseen by the People's Bank of China has used a web of Luxembourgian shell companies, all located at the same address, to amass holdings that include a 5-star hotel in Amsterdam, as well as a pair of Brussels buildings that house the Belgian police and several EU agencies. The fund also has stakes in everything from ferry services to gas companies to a financial markets clearinghouse. China insists this is just shrewd business, but there's an undeniable espionage risk with Beijing serving as landlord to strategic institutions at the heart of Europe. The last word, our feature article, turning protest into a crime. Eric Davis was one of thousands of Minnesotans who rallied peacefully against ICE, said Sam Levin in the Guardian. Now the U.S. government is trying to send him to prison for 6 years. Eric Davis was driving to a medical appointment in St. Paul, Minnesota on June 16th when federal agents surrounded his car. They hauled me out and put me in a belly chain, recalled the 53-year-old. He was arrested on the spot with charges of being part of a conspiracy to impede or injure Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers. Davis, a college professor and father of two, was one of thousands of Minnesotans who had rallied earlier this year when the Trump administration launched an aggressive crackdown on immigrants in the Twin Cities. Now the government alleged that he and 14 others used force, intimidation, and threats to prevent officers from carrying out their duties. In its 94-page indictment, the government has argued that Direct Action Minnesota, the loose coalition of organizers that Davis was connected with, conspired to obstruct federal law enforcement and had ties to Antifa. The prosecution follows a pattern seen in other cases against demonstrators this year, with the government highlighting the comments and actions of some activists in the coalition to paint all 15 defendants as agitators pursuing violence against ICE. One such case in Chicago spectacularly collapsed last month. Demonstrators in Texas were recently convicted of terrorism charges and sentenced to decades behind bars, though in that case one protester shot and injured an officer. Prosecutors have not alleged any specific injuries to officers in Minnesota. Civil rights advocates have said these prosecutions, even when unsuccessful, are part of an effort to criminalize lawful community organizing, weaken movements opposing deportations, and turn the lives of activists upside down. Davis, the government says, has attended and facilitated meetings about protest and discussed his anti-authoritarian ideology with other activists. He is not accused of violent acts, taking any specific actions at protests, or having any encounters with ICE agents. He is facing 6 years in prison. "It's petty revenge," Davis said. "They're trying to portray being part of a community as an illegal conspiratorial act." Davis and other defendants, interviewed by The Guardian, are confident that the case against them will collapse. "But the government is trying to send a signal," Davis said. "This isn't just about us. It's about trying to scare everybody who opposes ICE." Davis is a Buddhist studies scholar at McAllister College in St. Paul, and has long been part of labor organizing and activism against police violence in the region. When federal agents flooded the Twin Cities in January in a massive effort to round up immigrants, he felt compelled to step up, he said. "It was a federal invasion and terror campaign on our streets. The behavior of those masked thugs was horrific. They were ripping human beings out of families." Outrage and local organizing efforts swelled following the killings of Renee Good and Alex Preddy. There were rapid response mutual aid networks, groups documenting ICE sightings, Know Your Rights training sessions, food donations for immigrant families trapped at home, and many joined signal groups with strangers to get plugged in. "It was astonishing. The overwhelming sense was that almost everybody was opposed and angry and scared. And almost everybody wanted to do something," said Davis, who joined hyperlocal group chats with neighbors. The indictment does not describe Davis orchestrating any specific protest plans, giving detailed directions to other activists, or conducting any violence. It does allege that on January 11th, 4 days after Good's killing, Davis helped facilitate an emergency meeting for residents interested in resistance to ICE that featured discussions of protest tactics like civil disobedience, marches, and blockades to stop ICE officers. Prosecutors also cite a post by Davis in a signal group 6 days later in which he shared information about upcoming protests and encouraged people to be at a federal immigration building. The indictment further notes that Davis suggested people delete the group while on the ground during the demonstrations, and that he participated in two additional meetings and a rally. The indictment accuses other defendants of more serious offenses. Eight of the other defendants are said to have participated in an action on March 1st, where demonstrators held shields and blocked vehicles from entering or leaving a federal building. Prosecutors say individuals threw projectiles at local sheriffs during the protest, but did not specify if any defendants were involved in that. Four defendants face charges for separate incidents. One is accused of telling people to get guns in January. One is accused of following an agent in May to Wisconsin, just across the state border. And one is accused of assault and destruction of government property after allegedly knocking paperwork out of an agent's hand and kicking an officer's car in May. The indictment doesn't allege Davis was involved in any of the incidents in March or May. According to the indictment, there are no allegations of injuries to specific ICE officers or charges of serious violence like there were in the recent federal prosecutions of protesters in Prairie Land, Texas, in which one protester shot and injured an officer. Daniel Rosen, the Minnesota U.S. attorney, said that whether the Minneapolis protesters caused physical harm was not the measure of criminality in this case. The broader suggestion of the indictment is that Davis' statements in signal chats and meetings, alongside the statements and actions of others, show the groups collectively were conspiring to oppose the U.S. government's authority and interfere with ICE, and that they were connected to Antifa groups that blend anarchist and communist views. At a press conference announcing the charges, Rosen said the prosecution supported the mission of Donald Trump's executive order last year that designated Antifa a domestic terrorist organization responsible for riots against ICE. Antifa is not a formal entity, but an umbrella term for a wide array of anti-fascist activism. To support the alleged Antifa connection, the Department of Justice has highlighted a photo showing one of the defendants wearing an I'm Antifa sweatshirt. Prosecutors also quoted another defendant's post on Facebook, "You will never win with nonviolence alone." The indictment does not cite any comments by Davis about Antifa. The charges don't define the relationships of the protesters to one another, nor does it provide evidence that defendants like Davis endorsed the more radical statements or actions of others facing charges. Authorities say Davis referred to his ideologies as anarchist, broadly anti-authoritarian, and broadly anti-capitalist, and praised the revolutionary potential of our organizations and militancy in a signal message. Spokespeople for the Department of Justice in Minnesota declined to comment. A Department of Homeland Security spokesperson declined to answer questions about the case, pointing to an earlier statement saying people who lay a hand on law enforcement will be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. Davis said his own political beliefs are focused on expanding equality and people's freedoms and opposing state violence and authoritarianism, far removed, he said, from the stereotype of a violent anarchist extremist. He said the meeting he helped facilitate involved more than 100 participants with a wide range of ideologies, a space for people to come together after Good's killing. "I'm not sure I'm described as anything illegal, which makes sense because I didn't." He noted it was common for people to delete signal chats at protests due to concerns about officers accessing phones during arrest. "It's bewildering. It seemed weird and laughable," Davis said of the indictment. "It felt like the length of the indictment was a cover for how thin it actually was. I'm a professor. I've seen people pad out papers when they've got nothing to say." Among the Minnesota protesters facing the most severe charges is Natasha Rakoltz. Rakoltz, a 45-year-old home health aide, said it took her a while to get involved in the organizing efforts after ICE arrived in the city. She said she wasn't connected to any activist groups and didn't know where to start, but she felt morally obligated. People say, if it was 1935 Germany, what would I do? I couldn't do nothing. I couldn't sit by and wait for them to kill somebody else. I couldn't sit in my privileged white existence and allow the government to absolutely ravage people that need protecting. It felt like nobody was going to save us. Rakoltz eventually linked up with groups monitoring ICE and threw herself into the work. Like Davis, Rakoltz faces conspiracy charges. The government says she participated in a signal chat focused on observing ICE vehicles, talking about what times she would be observing and how she takes photos of license plates. She asked others what they had observed and said she was interested in learning more about civil disobedience. But in addition, the Justice Department says that on May 18th, Rakoltz followed a federal immigration officer's vehicle, brake checked and sideswiped the car, causing a collision. The indictment does not provide further details. Rakoltz has denied the allegation. State records show local officers called to the scene of the collision, cited her for a misdemeanor of allegedly violating her duty to drive with due care, a minor offense. A court report said she told an officer she was not following the federal agent and the collision was an accident. She was not arrested at the time. Eventually, state prosecutors dropped the misdemeanor, saying federal prosecutors were filing charges covering the indictment or the incident. The U.S. Attorney's Office has since accused Rakoltz of assault on an officer with a charge alleging physical contact and injury, though the indictment doesn't identify a victim or specify the injuries the collision may have caused, and it doesn't detail any damage to the government's car. That charge could carry a 20-year sentence on top of 6 years for conspiracy. I really believe these charges are going to get dropped because they're unfounded and ridiculous, said Rakoltz. But I feel like the process is the punishment. Trial date has not been set, and complicated cases like this can drag on for months. In the meantime, the consequences of the case have been far-reaching for defendants. They are trying to ruin our lives. I try not to remind myself all the time that the consequence of this bureaucracy is my freedom, Davis said. Davis worries about impacts on his career. He said he has long striven to keep his academic work and activism separate, but now thrust into the spotlight as an alleged conspirator, he wonders if his scholarship could be affected. He has struggled to sleep, and the case has taken a toll on his personal relationships, he said. The 15 defendants are under a strict no-contact order with one another, which has meant he has been cut off from several close friends, who are also defendants in the case. He has worked hard to not dwell on the possibility of being locked up for 6 years. I suspect I'm going to be afraid at some point, and we'll have to process that. But I've been able to be unafraid because of the support and solidarity we received. Both Davis and Rakoltz said they didn't want the case to discourage others from organizing against ICE and hoped people would stay focused on immigrant communities subjected to ICE enforcement and violence. Far more important than anything that happens to us is continuing to organize around the armed mask people in our streets, Davis said. Rakoltz said she, too, had tried not to think about what a conviction would mean. I am free right now, and I refuse to let this stop me from enjoying life and doing what I can to positively impact the community. She paused. And if I have to go to prison because I did what I could for the greater good, I'm ready and willing to do that. This story originally appeared in The Guardian. We'll read a couple of the health and science pieces today. When every tribe had its own tongue. Humans today speak roughly 7,500 languages, from Mandarin to Spanish to a wealth of indigenous tongues. While that may sound like a lot, we likely had as much as 10 times that many just a few thousand years ago, reports Smithsonian. A new study estimates that we once communicated in anywhere from 20,000 to 75,000 distinct languages during what researchers call a linguistic golden age. Because most ancient tongues vanished without a trace, the team reconstructed how human speech rose and fell by analyzing population estimates and ethnographic data stretching back 12,000 years, and by looking at current hunter-gatherer peoples, each of which tends to have its own language. Before farming took hold, they concluded, people across the world spoke between 4,500 and 6,200 languages. Once crops and livestock were domesticated, populations swelled and languages multiplied. The diversity crested between 1000 BC and AD 1000, then fell away as expanding empires spread their dominant languages, wiping out what existed earlier through conquest and even pathogens. Today, about 4 languages die off each year, and as many as 1,500 could disappear by the end of the century. The languages that persist, the researchers say, may not be the fittest so much as the luckiest, spoken by populations that happen to grow and spread. Are there people who developed languages with some traits that we can barely imagine now? Asked geneticist Chiara Barberi, who wasn't involved in the study. It makes your head spin. How whales sleep. Sperm whales doze in one of nature's strangest poses, hanging motionless below the surface like giant vertical logs, heads tipped sometimes up, sometimes down toward the deep. But how do they hold that position without bobbing upward or drifting sideways? The answer, reports the Times from UK, is that they blow bubbles. Whales are naturally buoyant thanks to the waxy spermaceti oil packed into their heads, and as they sleep, the air in their lungs gradually expands, threatening to float them to the surface. To counter that force, they let out small puffs of gas from their blowholes, trimming their buoyancy until they hover almost motionless. Researchers at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland made the discovery by fixing suction cup tags to 42 whales, which they used to record movement and sound. It is particularly fascinating they are able to make these fine scale adjustments while they are thought to be asleep, said co-author Patrick Miller, a challenge totally alien to terrestrial mammals like us humans. And we're over on the Talking Points page. I think we can get a couple of articles today. Fauci, the GOP's COVID scapegoat. COVID killed more than 1.1 million Americans, but in the twisted narrative that has become Republican Party dogma, said Will Salatin in the Bulwark, the villain isn't Trump, China, or even the virus. It's Anthony Fauci. At a Senate committee hearing last week, Republicans demonized and slandered Fauci, now retired director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, who served the public under 7 presidents back to Ronald Reagan. Several senators suggested Fauci helped China create the virus in a lab, even though studies have traced its probable origin to animals in the Wuhan wet market. Representative Anna Paulina Luna compared Fauci to Nazi Dr. Joseph Mengele. Senator Ron Johnson ludicrously suggested COVID vaccines were experimental gene therapy that killed millions of Americans. Fauci declined to answer questions on the grounds that committee chair Rand Paul had vowed to use his testimony to put him in prison. Why the witch hunt? For Trump's GOP, someone has to be blamed for what went wrong in the pandemic. And it can't be the party's God King. Fauci and other health officials did make mistakes, said Megan McArdle in the Washington Post. The messaging on masking was muddled, and schools stayed closed longer than they had to. But public health experts were doing the best they could in an unprecedented disaster. What we need is the kind of systematic, nonpartisan, and non-punitive investigation that followed previous national crises, not a mean-spirited blame game that serves only to make us less prepared for the next pandemic. The official who really bungled the pandemic was the man in charge, Donald J. Trump, said Molly Olmsted in Slate. But with Republicans likely to take a beating in November, they're using a boogeyman Fauci as a tool to distract and energize their fractured base. As an alternative to Fauci and science, said Nick Cottagio in the Dispatch, Trump and his populist allies are offering witch doctor lunatics. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. denied this week that COVID vaccines, which saved millions of lives, did more good than harm, and claimed that at the height of the pandemic's ICUs were empty all over the country, including in New York. Rather than a serious effort to explore what went wrong with COVID, Republicans are giving us crackpot conspiracy theories, quack miracle cures like ivermectin, and pseudo-experts with brains worms, literally. Sex education, bringing back teen pregnancy. The Trump administration is recycling the failed message that teens should be sexually abstinent, said Jill Filipovich in Slate, and urging them to forego contraception, get married, and plan their lives around having babies. The Department of Health and Human Services recently canceled 53 of 67 grants, totaling $68 million, provided through the decades-old Teen Pregnancy Prevention Program. The federal government will now provide grants only to sex education organizations that emphasize fertility over contraception, falsely depict the pill and hormonal contraception as dangerous, and urge teens to prepare for marriage and parenthood. The new guideline bans any content that encourages, normalizes, or promotes sexual activity for minors. Since TPP began in 2010, the birth rate for 15 to 19-year-olds has decreased by over 65%, reaching a record low 11.7 births per 1,000 last year. Now HHS is stripping money from the programs that sent teen pregnancy rates tumbling to put it toward those that tell teens that actually reproduction is the goal. But the teen birth rate has been declining since the 1990s, long before TPP, said Michael J. New in National Review. HHS tried to refocus grants toward abstinence education during Trump's first term, but grantees sued and kept their funding. They're doing so again, and conservatives should hope Trump is more successful this time. The purpose of sex ed has changed, said Kat Rosenfield in the Free Press. Preventing unplanned teen pregnancies and sexually transmitted disease was a reasonable and appropriate goal when they were more common, but it doesn't make much sense in a world where young people are barely having sex compared with previous generations. The new sex ed policy is purely political, said Danielle Hahn and Jezebel. Eliminating comprehensive sex ed was one of the goals of Project 2025, the blueprint for Trump's second term. Anti-abortion activists have sought to change the curricula to stigmatize abortion and teach young people that life begins at conception. Legal abortion, contraception, and comprehensive sex ed helped bring the teen pregnancy rate to its historic lows, said Lisa Needham in Daily Kos. But conservative creeps are actually sad that teen birth rates are down. They aim to boost population growth. Well, population growth for white people, which is what the disgusting pronatalist movement is really about. Under Trump, sex ed now amounts to more teen pregnancies, please. And a couple of the short notes. public use of profanity is rising among politicians. Of the 692 instances in which presidents, vice presidents, and leading presidential candidates have deployed strong language since 1919, all but 87 occurred in the past decade. President Trump and former President Joe Biden account for 78% of the recent profanity, though Trump's language runs much hotter than that of Biden, who favored damn. More Americans now use marijuana on a daily or near daily basis than use alcohol, according to federal data. Some 21.4 million Americans use cannabis at least 300 days a year, up 21% from 2021. The number of Americans who drink alcohol daily or nearly daily dropped 24% in that period to 17.2 million. On the poll watch, 73% of Americans say President Trump has not paid enough attention to the country's most important problems. 67% believe Trump's military decisions in Iran have hurt the U.S. 74% say the president does not have a clear plan for winning or ending the war. And we'll wrap up today's show with a cute little quote from Reba McEntire. She says, "To succeed in life, you need three things: a wishbone, a backbone, and a funny bone." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please join us again next time. This is Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.